Coming up next in This Week in Computer Hardware, overclock your power supply, the Devil 13, and AMD's missing 7970. More SATA ports, you can have them all. And why you should ignore specs when you're buying hardware. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 183, recorded August 23rd, 2012. Overclock your power supply. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton, and this is the show where we do our best to bring you the most important news in PC and Macintosh hardware each and every week. And yes, we sprinkle a little love from the worlds of Android and iPad tablets and, hey, you know what, Windows tablets too. Joining me as always, Mr. Ryan Shrout from PCPer.com. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I think we were talking a little bit before the show. It's one of those times here at the PC Perspective offices where we have about 9 projects going at the same time, none of them in a successful status. And it's a little bit frustrating at times, you know, and it's, as with always, kind of like running to the last minute to try to get things done by anybody else's schedule. So, but hey, we got enough time. We gathered all of our exciting news and stuff to talk about for the week. So
exciting news is exciting. It was funny. I noticed a link to the Berry Point fire, which I was not able to see when I drove into Lakeview, Oregon this morning. I think it's 70% contained now, which means they have a ring around it. And one of the people I know up here, actually, the fire was 3 miles from their house, and they were about to have to leave their house and all of their things inside of it because the fire was coming. So very, very glad that that did not happen.
Yeah.
We should probably talk about technology being a tech show. And I got to say, this is a bag of awesome. Building a PC with legacy hardware, we're going to get to the new and exciting and expensive, and actually in the case of AMD, who's racing to the bottom, not so expensive hardware. But what were you thinking with the PC? I know you were doing this, but I still can't believe you actually did it. Oh, wait, this isn't the one I was thinking of. This is not the one made out of the old hardware. No, this is the one made out of the old
this
hardware.
This is. It's done by
Tony,
Chris.
You can edit this part out where I sound like a complete idiot. You actually built it. I thought you were kind of half kidding about the new old stock parts and stuff.
This is actually an article by Chris, who's just kind of like a guest guy. He said, hey, I had this project and, you know, wanted to pass this off to us. And it was a funny idea, right? And if you look at the first picture of the story, when we talked about this on the podcast last night, it's like, I think all of us have, if you're a tech nerd, if you're a hardware guy, you have a closet that looks like this, right? Where you've got maybe some shelving in there and it's got multiple power supplies. There's keyboards, there's motherboards. You can see a gigabyte, 2 gigabyte motherboards in there. There's a box of Cavassier cognac. I imagine that it has hardware in it as well.
Maybe it's emergency cognac for when system builds aren't going well.
You know, and I think we all have various areas like this in our house, some more than others. I am probably on the more than others side, just because of the nature of the beast with our work and all that kind of stuff.
I completely understand.
And I know this is something that you kind of take to heart. Like, how can I reuse this hardware that I already have? You've got all this old hardware. What can we do with it? What kind of repurposed methods can we use to take advantage of some of this older, but not super old, kind of legacy hardware?
I got to say, I'm really impressed that his closet not only includes what we can see in there, but his old Commodore 64 floppy disk drive with Zork 5 1/4 inch floppies, which might be worth something on eBay, a set of 4 30-pin, 1 megabyte, 70 nanosecond SIM chips that cost $100 each as upgrades to his first 486DX 250 megahertz Computine PC back in 1989. Now, I will admit to still owning a perfectly functional Compaq Portable 2, and I'm pretty sure I have some state-of-the-art memory from 1997. Yeah, I'm just as bad. I'm actually in the process of recycling all of this through.
Have you ever looked at that and like, maybe I could build a system out of this for my son, or maybe I could build a system out of this for my parents, or anything like that?
I think at some point, all of the stuff that I can cannibalize that's it's of relatively modern vintage has been cannibalized. And I have some boxes gotcha. Where it's like, I found my favorite Dell Pentium notebook of all time, which I got to keep, that I used at Windows Sources Magazine. And it has trackball in it. And it's awesome, and it's amazing, and it's a little slow now, and it doesn't really connect to the internet in a meaningful fashion, because, you know, it was Windows 95, but,
wow,
you know, but I'm sitting there, and I'm like, what could I run on this? Like, I could maybe, you know, I could run, like, a web page on it.
Sure.
In Linux.
So the reason he kind of had this idea was he does a little podcasting and audio recording work, and he wanted to have a PC that was silent or as close to silent as possible, which is something we get a lot on This Week in Computer Hardware. People ask us about that a lot. And so he was like, well, let me dive into this closet full of hardware and see what kind of components I can get out of there. And it's kind of interesting to see what he tried first versus what he ended up with. On the second page of it, you can see like the first take of what he actually built. He found a Gigabyte right. P35 motherboard that was from 2008 with a Core 2 quad processor. Well, no, the motherboard's capable of Core 2 quad, but he actually installed a Celeron E3300 processor. Used a stock Intel heatsink. He found 4 gigs of DDR2 memory. Actually has a relatively modestly new graphics card that he put in there, Radeon HD 5450, but it is passive. 160 gig Caviar blue hard drive, an old 430 watt Thermaltake power supply, and an old Thermaltake case, a bunch of other things like Soyo. Remember? Do you remember that company?
Yeah,
they made motherboards and all kinds of stuff. I didn't know, but apparently they made monitors as well.
Huh. I could do this in the Texzilla pile of parts. Now that I think about it,
yeah,
I could.
Yeah,
really
exactly.
Do this in the Texzilla pile of parts.
So the interesting thing when he built this first system was, it wasn't nearly as silent as he was hoping it was going to be, right? That Intel right. stock cooler, which we have plenty of here and we use in system builds here. Pretty close. It's a pretty yeah. close representation of the sound. So he went out and if you look on the third page, it ended up buying a couple of components in order to try to meet the original goal. Uh-huh. He found a giant Cooler Master 212 heatsink that he actually did run without a fan for a little while. But I think eventually he got a little nervous. And then he did buy a fanless power supply as well. But when those things were done, I think he added an SSD instead of the hard drive. And it's pretty close to silent. And all he had to buy was essentially a heatsink, a power supply, and right. an SSD. So motherboard, processor, case, you know, that kind of stuff. And if you're not worried about the silent part of it, he could have got right. away with using all the components that he had in his closet. So it's one of those things where I'd be curious to see if this inspires anybody else to go into the basement or go into the closet, Lord help us all, and start to filter through all of this stuff. Like I know for a fact, sitting in my basement, there are 3 CRT displays. And
MAME cabinet.
I don't know.
Actually, what size are they? How many inches are they?
One of them is a 22. Pretty big.
So close.
Huge and heavy. It was like a 2048 by 1536 resolution.
Oh, wow.
At the time, it was a big deal. And now it sits in the basement, and it hasn't been powered on in I don't know how many years.
You should bring it back. Bring it back up into the light. It's hurting down there.
I can try to put it on this desk and see if it holds it. See if this IKEA desk can actually hold the weight of these older CRT displays. It'd be funny.
Yeah.
So this was an article kind of in the vein of what we did a month or two ago, where Matt went out and tried to build a legacy gaming computer. It would run Windows 98 and all that kind of stuff and play old games like Descent, that kind of thing. This is like a similar idea. Let's take advantage of this old stuff.
It's so awesome. Not quite as awesome, but oops, sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to segue into the Synaptics.
Go for it.
Sorry.
Got a little bit more latency than normal on our conversation.
I was going to say, I have a funny feeling the ping time is going up. And 3, 2, not quite as awesome, but certainly delightful. Synaptics has announced new touchpads and keyboards. The Force Pad, which is 3 millimeters thin, and the Click Pad, which is 5.5 millimeters thin. These, of course, are designed for laptops, aren't they, Ryan?
Yeah, these are laptop touchpads, and they Synaptics is not a company we're used to hearing from, right. With like publicity and PR and marketing, all that kind of stuff. But they're trying to really take hold in these markets, right? So the force pad is interesting in that it can detect how much pressure you are putting on the touchpad. So it doesn't actually depress any like the click pad does. It doesn't actually, get pushed down. But if you were to have your finger on the touchpad and then press down on it, it would actually detect that force. That's actually the keyboard part that's a little bit separate. But the idea of the force pad is that it's thinner than the click pad, meaning you have more space to either make a thinner chassis or to add battery life or, to add battery capacity or something like that. But I don't know. I mean, can you think of any instances where kind of pressure sensitive touchpads would be useful or something like that? I think one of the guys last night joked that they called it the punchable laptop and it could tell when you bang your fist.
Well,
on the
machine. What about for artists? I mean, there's always been kind of a dream that the artist would be able to use their finger on a Wacom tablet. but the idea that you could integrate that sort of pressure sensitive technology into a notebook is kind of attractive. Measuring the precise amount of force user inputs that make it possible to drop physical left, right mouse buttons entirely.
Yeah, so if you go down to the keyboard called the Thin Touch, it's the same idea. This one's kind of interesting in that it is able to, apparently, I haven't tried it in person yet, emulate key travel, right? Which is one of the things that I think most keyboard enthusiasts look back on and say, this is what makes a keyboard feel comfortable specific to their, what they like and don't like is how much key travel is there. And with laptops, it's always been a problem because you try to make the laptop as thin as possible. So the amount of space that the key actually has to travel is fairly minimal. You look at chiclet keyboards as, kind of like the epitome of all that kind of stuff. And the Thin Touch key attempts to do it by actually like you kind of depress into the key as opposed to pushing the key itself down.
Yeah, they also say that it'll actually give you alternate characters depending on how hard you push on the key. I have my much like Matt Smith, the author of the article, I have my reservations about how useful this keyboard will be or just in terms of what its tactile feel will be. Because I don't have particularly fond memories of some of the foam keyboards that have been made or the sort of rubberized keyboards. I mean, it's a neat piece of engineering. It's like half the size of a regular key. It has a backlight integrated. It has force sensing technology. So, it kind of reminds me of when you're speaking in Chinese, if you end with the syllable going up or down or in the middle, it can change the meaning of the word. So if I am, a little aggravated when I'm emailing, someone, what will that turn into? You know what I mean? If you're pressing really hard, will it suddenly, bring craziness to your email or your document? I'm curious,
I was supposed to get some hands-on time with this stuff, but the meeting that we were supposed to have in New York didn't really work out the way it was supposed to. But I'm hoping to get some of that hands-on time with it and kind of report back because that's one of the things that I really like about my Lenovo laptop is the keyboard very specifically, right? It's one of the major
pleasure
features
to use.
Yeah. And it's, when I go to some of these first generation, second generation Ultrabooks, it's a very different experience. I don't want to say if it's bad, maybe it's something you can get used to over time, but not great.
Yeah, I don't know. It's frustrating. I mean, the keyboards on the MacBook Air aren't too bad. The keyboards on the Ultrabook seem to be all over the map. It was kind of funny. We had the Acer S5 on recently, and I still can't get over how afraid I am of the Magic Flip dying. And I kind of wonder if Acer was worried about that too, because they put the power cord is like the only thing that's not on the Magic Flip that comes down.
This is the one with the motorized, like,
yeah, we reviewed it on Techzilla last week, and the little door comes down and it's got your USB ports, your HDMI port, your Thunderbolt port. So it's going to be interesting to watch vendors work their way through the problem of delivering incredibly thin notebooks without having Apple's resources. Speaking of resources, to make another awkward segue, AMD's cutting prices on GPUs yet again, which is kind of exciting, actually, if you're looking for something in the neighborhood of like an NVIDIA GTX 660i or the AMD HD 7870. It's kind of funny. AMD's cutting their prices, presumably to compete better in the market with NVIDIA. Man, so end of this week, new price cuts. Can AMD afford to sort of race to the bottom with NVIDIA? What's going on here, man?
I have no idea if they can or cannot, right? They're obviously going to do it. I think they benefit a little bit because they were first into the game with this generation of graphics. And because of that, they were able to charge higher prices for the beginning of the life cycle. And they're obviously, I think they knew this was going to come, right? They knew that NVIDIA would come out, they'd be really, really competitive on price per dollar or performance per dollar, and they would have to drop prices to kind of stay in line with all that kind of stuff. So with the 660 Ti launch, it really kind of pushed AMD's hand on this. The 660 Ti came out at $299. It was, you know, AMD was pitting that it was going to go up against the 7870, but in reality, it really competed against the 7950. So the 7950 was selling for $50 more. Now the 7950 sells for $20 more. It's a much closer margin, and the 7870 has decreased to about $50 lower. So the graph that we posted that AMD kind of sent around to everybody, not the graph, but the diagram, is a little bit takes some liberties in terms of performance comparisons. Yeah, right. Like they show the 7950 going head to head with the 670, and then it has a significantly lower price. Well, it doesn't really go against the 670. And in my opinion, everything on the green column should be shifted up about half a position, and then it would be a little bit more accurate to the performance metrics of everything. And then if you do that, actually, all the prices kind of make sense. It's like a nice step down between each side. You go 519, 429, 399, 319, 299, 249. You know, it's just, it goes back and forth as opposed to being on one side of the market or so. But lower prices, obviously better for everybody, except for, you know, the people that are selling it to get money. But good for the consumer.
Maybe they expect to sell more. Yeah, no, it's getting to be. It seems like every week it's a better and better time to buy GPUs. From the incredibly over the top department, should we start with the Devil 13 or the 1500 watt power supply?
Let's go with the Devil 13 because I want to get that one out of the way. This one was just started to leak out today. This is a power color. There's a little bit of a debate on whether or not they're going to call this the HD 7990 or the 7970 X2. Apparently, they showed like a really early stage mock-up of this at Computex. And at the time, they were calling it the 7970 X2, which basically means that it was a custom-designed, custom-built PCB that they put two Tahiti class 7970 GPUs on. It wasn't, you know, a design from AMD, right? And so that's why they went with the X2 moniker that AMD hasn't used in a couple of generations. Well, apparently, according to some people, this three-slot monster of a graphics card has been given permission to use the 7990 name. So we'll see what it actually comes out as. And keep in mind, the 7990 is one of those things that we have been waiting for quite some time. Like, we've been hearing about it since the original release of the 7970, and nothing has come of it. So it's almost possible that with this kind of news leaking out, that maybe AMD is not going to do their own design of 7990, and they're going to let their partners kind of create these super custom parts, which is fine, except for I believe that these cards are going to be much more expensive than than it would be if AMD had designed it and released it, right? That kind of thing. So
it's interesting with the Double 13, because obviously this is one of those sort of, you're not just buying a GPU, you're buying an experience. And if you got $1,000 for a GPU that looks like it belongs on a True Blood advertisement, it is probably the one you should look at. That'd be interesting. So there's no real release date for 7990.
No. There's definitely not. And when I talked to them last time, I guess it was about high-end parts. It's the 7970 gigahertz edition, and they really had no information. They weren't willing to budge on any of that stuff. So anybody's guess is as good as mine at this point. I don't know. The GTX 690 from NVIDIA really put them in a spot, right? Because if they can't release a 7990 and have a higher performing card and or a lower price, there's no point in releasing it. If they're going to be slower and more expensive, nobody will buy that product, especially if we're talking about a $1,000 part. So
right.
Do what you got to do.
Goodness. So if you are looking for the ultimate power supply, a power supply that is literally consuming as much power as most space heaters that plug in your electrical service, you will be excited to hear about EVGA's new Next 1500 classified PSU, overclocks to 1650 watts, says Tim Berry over at PCPer.com. So this is unhinged. If you take a look at the corner of this, there's something you very, very rarely see. If you can, it's actually just a picture of the power supply itself, not the handle, but over the handle on the power supply, there's actually like a 20 amp medical grade power cable, mm-hmm. which you can buy those power cables. I know, because I had to track them for a couple of Dell cases I own with similarly over the top power supplies. But this is really over the top. I mean, the cabling is actually really beautiful. They have this huge, massive, looks like you're using it to power a shop vac or something, this big, thick, huge cable that goes with it. You know, ATX, 8-pin CPU power sockets, PCI Express, a lot of 12 SATA connections, 8 Molex connections, 2 floppy connections, 1 USB connection. $449. And monitoring software for monitoring the power supply, which I assume is what the USB connection is for. Or does mm-hmm. it actually include a USB connection?
It will have a USB connection that goes directly, connects right inside on your motherboard, right? Wow. So it'll connect into the motherboard. It ships in a, it has a configurable rail, it has a configurable rail configuration, I guess. It can do single rail or multi-rail. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, wow.
You mentioned the overclocked to 1650 watts. If you have a, you have to have a 230 volt AC line for that. But and it has a 10-year warranty, apparently, which is pretty impressive.
That's pretty awesome. It's also capable of pulling something like, if you can max this thing out by attaching enough like 4 of the hopefully soon to come 7970 GPUs and a stack of hard drives, this thing could pull 13 amps through your electrical system. So watch yourself if you have inferior wiring.
Dedicate an entire circuit to it without a doubt. Yeah.
Yeah, that's like air conditioner numbers, space heater numbers. That is a lot of amperage to be sucking down. You want to suck down Twitch? That didn't come out right. http://twit.tv/twitch is the URL. It's where you can find our podcast, listen to them, watch them, download them. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or basically any podcaster you love. Get the links to twit.tv/twitch. We love your email questions. twitch@twit.tv is the email address. And let us start with an email from Charles. He says, first up, I love the show. Great to watch as I fly across the country all the time. Glad we can help your day through, Charles. He says, I have a PC with a Core i7-2700 chip, a Z68 Asus P8 Z68V Gen 3 socket 1155 motherboard. The motherboard uses the ASMedia chipset for the USB 3.0 controller. I have issues where my USB 3.0 devices will either not be recognized or lose connection after 5 to 10 minutes. They work fine on USB 2.0. but at the slower rate. I have updated the firmware on the chip and the drivers. This continues to happen. My question is, would it be helpful to upgrade to a Z77 motherboard like the one on PC per high-end system build page? I know the USB 3.0 is integrated into the chipset, but will it be helpful since I have a Sandy Bridge processor? I was unsure if you could use the USB 3.0 on the Z77 motherboard with a Sandy Bridge chip. Ryan?
I've never heard of a USB device like losing its connection after 5 to 10 minutes. It doesn't really, I mean, are these external hard drives? If they're external hard drives, is maybe the power timing out? Is it maybe shutting down or something like that? He says it doesn't happen on his laptop with USB 3.0 ports. This is not a problem I've really come across, and I really doubt that the Asus Z68 motherboard is, you know, in any way drastically inferior to what a Z77 board would do. Right. I would double check that you have the latest BIOS. I would go into the BIOS or UEFI and check to see if there's a setting about USB sleep timers or something like that. Maybe if a device is, you know, unused for X number of minutes or something like that, it puts it into a lower power state or something like that, and that's actually kind of powering down the device. Because that's the only thing I could think of.
I mean, this is a motherboard with like, yeah, 4-star. Basically, the review average on Newegg is 4 stars for the Asus P8 D68V Pro Gen 3, which I love saying, which is a strong sign that it is not a motherboard full of fail. And actually, I couldn't even find a single reference to USB 3.0 on it. Right. Well, no, I found a few references, but so far, none of them particularly negative. So, you know, if a bunch of people were experiencing massive fails with USB 3.0, I think we probably would have heard about it. Are there cabling issues? Is everything hooked up correctly inside the PC? Is something FUBAR'd inside your operating system? I would probably check all of these things. Because USB, even USB 3.0 is kind of done. It's baked. It's not something where you're kind of waiting for. You should be waiting for firmware to make USB 3.0 work properly. It's probably something else inside your system.
Yeah, and that board uses the Asmedia controller, as he mentions. It doesn't even use kind of like the super early NEC controller. You know, check your BIOS, check your drivers, go to the Asus.com website and go to the download section and make sure you have the latest of both of those and give that a shot. We've got an email from Dr. Rob who wants to know why NVIDIA strangled the bus. So we'll have to get a description here. Guys, love the show and watch pretty much every week. Actually, Dr. Rob, you should be watching every week, not pretty much every week. Keep that in mind. With all the video card news, I have been thinking, maybe lusting for a new card. I currently have a GTX 570 with a 320-bit bus. The NVIDIA 670, 680, and 690 have 256-bit widths, and the 660 drops back to 192 bits. Why the bus bit width drop? Wow, that's hard to say. Why the bus bit width drop on the new cards? And would I see a performance drop from the smaller bus width on a Z68 board? So the motherboard has nothing to do with the memory bus configuration of your graphics card. Yes, the 570, the Fermi cards had larger memory bus widths, 320 bits. And we stepped down to 256 bits with the first Kepler cards, and yes, 192 on the 660. While that's an important statistic, while it's an important feature or number to know on your graphics card, all it is one variable in an equation that comes to, you know, the result of gaming performance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the same way when people look at, well, the AMD cards have 2,500, 3,000 shaders. The NVIDIA ones have half that many. Well, they're not created equal. And the same thing is true with the bus width. Keep in mind that the memory speed on Kepler is at 6 gigabits per second. That's much faster than what Fermi was able to run. So actually, what you shouldn't even worry about the memory bus width, if you're actually looking for a spec to compare, look at what the memory bus bandwidth is. So I know on Kepler, it's 194 gigabytes per second on the 680 and 670 and 690. Compare that to your 570 and see where it stacks up. But even then, even if the 570 is a little bit higher, it doesn't matter if the benchmarks show that one it's gaming is faster on Kepler, right? Maybe Kepler is a more balanced architecture. 320-bit memory bus is both expensive when you build a die, and it may have been unnecessary for the architecture design that Kepler uses. Now it's each SMX, excuse me, each like kind of processor grouping in Kepler has 192 processors instead of 64 or 32 that Fermi had. So maybe that changes things around a lot. I don't like to see guys or girls, enthusiasts, really worried about these kind of odd specifications. Even you start looking at clock speed, memory bus width, shader counts, ROP counts. If you're really down into the tech and you wanted to know, well, why did they drop that? Then there's an answer. But if you're saying, am I going to get less gaming performance because my 570 has a larger memory bus width? You're not looking at the right data point.
That's what benchmarks are for.
Yeah, exactly. We can look at specs and talk about them all day long on this show, on PCPro.com, on TechZilla, any of that. And it doesn't really matter. That's why at the end of the day, the majority of the pages on my reviews are games, resolutions, quality settings. It is what you actually get for the money you're spending.
Trust us, Dr. Rob, you will enjoy the new cards despite their lower number of I just love that question. I just thought it was a great question. So thank you, Dr. Rob, for sending it in.
Yeah.
Interesting one from David. He writes in, I have a Core i7-2600 hooked up to, it's a gigabyte motherboard, a cheap SSD RAID card, 500-watt power supply, 320 gigabyte SSDs, 5 assorted hard disk drives, mostly 2 terabyte Western Digital Caviar Greens, which sounds like something in my house. What would you recommend for a motherboard and power supply unit that has a lot of SATA connections? Ideally, I'd like something that supports 32 gigabytes of RAM, but it would handle at least 16 gigabytes. Also, if you know of any cases that will handle drives, that would be helpful. Thanks, Dave. So we should probably talk about SATA ports first. You get 6 max on a motherboard with an LGA 1155 Intel chipset, the platform controller hub, which is, I'm going to say, almost all of Ivy Bridge gets 6 ports. 2 of them will be SATA 3. The rest will be SATA 2, the slower, you know, basically 2 of them will be 6. The rest of them will be 3 gigabits per second, which isn't a particularly big deal. In terms of power supply unit, any of the manufacturers that have been reviewed on PCPer, hardsap.com, they got a good deal. When you're talking about, if you are not using, GPUs are sucking in a lot more power than your hard drives at this point. At least it feels that way. I can remember back in the day when loading 6 hard drives in a case would cripple the power supply. Nowadays, I don't think most 500-watt power supplies will even notice 6 hard drives. But, you know, if you want to go for overkill, get a 750-watt power supply, and you'll know you own a 750-watt power supply even though you don't need it. I would buy it from a reputable manufacturer. There are lots of mysterious but documentable or let's just call it mysterious but that I believe in connections between bad power from cheap power supplies and hard drive failures. Hard drives like clean power. They function better with it. It's kind of funny. I've seen a lot of also motherboard issues. Less now than maybe 5 or 6 years ago. But it used to be like 5 or 10 years ago, it was amazing how many people's problems you could solve by updating their power supply and get them a decent power supply.
Well, I was going to say, while the chipset itself is limited to 6 SATA ports, you'll find motherboards that will have more ports than that. They're basically integrating discrete controllers directly on the motherboard as well. So I know you could buy external cards, but your best bet is to find a motherboard that integrates that kind of stuff. He's got the H67A motherboard up there, right? So...
would you go with a board with more parts over adding a PCI Express cards into its existing board?
If he's trying to save money, then yes, you can add a card in. If you've got a PCI Express slot, you can get a card that can do 4 more hard drives, that kind of thing. The only thing you have to keep in mind, and this is the case, the topology, the electrical way it functions between getting a motherboard and adding in a PCI Express storage card versus having a motherboard and having that chip located on the motherboard itself with the ports on the motherboard itself are identical. Right. And what I'm trying to insinuate with that is, if you're trying to run RAID with these different drives, you need to make sure that all the drives that you want to run RAID are on the same controller.
Got it. Right.
So if you wanted to do RAID with all five of those assorted hard drives, or maybe you had four of the 2 terabyte Western Digital Greens, and you wanted to do RAID with that, they need to all be hooked up to one controller, whether or not that's the add-in card or the Intel PCH.
In terms of, I'm trying to remember, there was one that I saw on Lime Technology, the Unraid website, where it was a server that had like 8 hard drive slots. And I'm not finding the name of that box. I apologize. Yeah, they found like, so they build a server here. If you go to lime-technology.com/products, the MD1510, it's a mid-tower enclosure with, I think, 15 drive slots in it. Aha! Lian Li's LanCool PC K12B case. This thing's pretty amazing. If you're looking to have all of the storage in your PC case, which I actually am on one of my PCs, but this may be the most completely over-the-top set of options out there. But yeah, 15 drive bays. That is a lot of drive bays, people. So just out of curiosity, Ron, what's the number of ports you've actually seen on a motherboard at this point?
If you're looking for like a modern board, like there's a Z77 board from ASRock that has 10 SATA ports on it, 6 of which are actually 6 gigabit per second ports.
Uh-huh.
So that's on the extreme side. And actually, I was just looking here. If we go to Z77 has quite a bit of options there for hard drive connectivity. There are several boards. If you get into the X79 territory, which would obviously be a whole platform change for him, I've seen a Gigabyte motherboard, I think, that has 12 SATA ports on it, something like that. So, but keep in mind, like, you're getting 6 from the Intel chipset, and then everything else is an extra chip on there. Maybe they're using a four-port chip. Maybe they're using a couple of 2-port chips, whatever it is. And then keep in mind that they're using eSATA for a lot of them as well. You know, any of those external SATA ports, maybe on the back or on the front panel connections, those all take advantage of those same type of controllers. So you can get a motherboard that has a lot of SATA connectivity in it. And if you need more, you can always go the route of the external cards. And if you don't want to upgrade your system, you can do that today.
I now covet a new motherboard for my Core i5 box, because I only have standard Intel 6 SATA connections, and now I want 12 on a single motherboard.
Yeah, you're falling behind. You gotta have more hard drives, obviously.
I've got 5 hard drives in the system. I have 4 hard drives and an SSD in the system. I got 12 terabytes of storage and an SSD, which sounds a lot like the beginning of a... let's not go there. What's coming up on PC Per this week, Ryan?
So on PC Per this week, we are going to have a roundup of 660 Ti graphics cards. I was actually trying to finish the overclocking testing this evening, trying to see which cards have the better coolers to be pushed the farthest. So having a little bit of issue with the overclocking software correctly functioning with all of the graphics cards. And then we will also have, we've got, what's the Lenovo Carbon laptop? Which one was that? X1, their new Ultrabook that I think it's got carbon fiber in it, I believe. I don't think the whole thing is that, but it is. We have a review of that going up.
I don't know. Is carbon fiber the new black notebooks?
Yes. Yeah, and it's strong and it's light, and maybe it doesn't bend like aluminum so that your laptop will stay in one position the whole time. Maybe.
I like it. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to have some fun next week, actually. Speaking of Ultrabooks, Lloyd Case is going to be joining us on Tuesday's show with a roundup of Ultrabooks. And we are going to get a little bit crazy, I believe, with digital cameras. I cannot say any more than that for safety's sake. Techzilla.com is the website where you can find myself and Veronica Belmont and Robert Herron. PCPer.com, which you may have heard us mention a few times in this web show, is Ryan Shrout's awesome collection of hardware reviewers. Busily.
Thank you.
Testing and delivering awesome analysis. You should go there, PCPer.com. I believe You can still find us, like I mentioned earlier, at twit.tv/twitch or email us twitch, T-W-I-C-H. There is no T in Twitch. T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv.
Can we maybe request that be a forwarded email address just in case?
That's a good idea.
Make a note. I'm going to write that one down. Okay. You're right.
Note to self.
Maybe even have the URL forward, twit.tv/twitch with a T to the right one, you know, that kind of stuff. Let's help people out.
Help us help you. We can help us help you. In any case, I think that's it for this week's edition of Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week on This Week in Computer Hardware.
Oh, we didn't talk about OnLive today. Damn.
Yeah.
I have a personal vendetta against them, so.
Ooh.
Please explain.
Do tell.
Surely you guys. That's personal. Maybe that was, I think that was when Leo was still doing the show. Before OnLive was actually launched, I got a hold of one of the beta logins, and so I used it, and I tested it.
Same
and
here.
I took videos, and I wrote it. And they sued me, and they had takedown notices for Amazon, which was our web host for videos and stuff, and YouTube, and they sent a lawyer out to my office and that kind of stuff.
Well, I'd never heard this.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty bad. And it was like this giant law firm.
And is that like you didn't sign an NDA or?
No, right. But
they expected you to follow.
Well, apparently when you were signing it, like when you logged in, like when you click agree to every EULA in the world ever.
Yes.
Somewhere in the EULA it was like.
So technically you were breaking the NDA.
Probably.
But
I was
buried under like 50 pages. Agreement.
But that was when I went on when Tom was still at CNET and I went on
This is a real long time.
Yeah, it was before OnLive launched. So, but I interviewed at several different, tech outlets and podcasts and that kind of stuff about it, and they were like they sent a local nicer law firm to talk to me. And they said, "Will you take it down?" And I was like, "No."
Take it down a notch.
And they're like, "Okay." And so the story's still up there. I thought it was a really good story. It had side-by-side videos that looked at the image quality if you played a game locally versus the image quality when you played the game over OnLive. Right. And I thought it was actually mostly positive about the service, but
so it wasn't like a smear article.
I mean, I said that it was not as good as advertised, that they were trying to what's that? Oh, January 20th.
I can see that freaking out a lawyer.
Yeah.
A junior manager.
This is my favorite part. The stipulation that they got me on for a copyright infringement was I took screenshots of their website that showed their data centers and that kind of stuff. And I said, here's where they're talking about their data centers and that kind of stuff. And it's freely available on their website. And I even put underneath the store, underneath each picture, image taken from blah, blah, blah.
Right. Gave them credit.
Yeah. And the videos are still apparently up there on S3, according to Ken. So.
Well, you were right, that's what man.
We call the chilling effect. Law firms do things for their clients that aren't necessarily legitimate just to crush you.